And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. A caring, quality teacher is a blessing for youngsters. Passion, creativity, and insight may stay with students for life. This hour, we visit with a former Miami-Dade Public School English teacher. He's David Menashe. He was an original faculty member at the acclaimed Coral Reef Magnet School in South Miami-Dade, and he joins us now. Welcome to you, David. Good to see you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you, and just want to mention that the name of David's book that he's written, a memoir, is The Priority List, A Teacher's Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons, and it's quite a moving account.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
So, David, you said you feel you need to prove something. You don't even know who you'd like to prove it to. What did you want to prove?
I wanted to prove to myself and others that even after being diagnosed with brain cancer and going blind and crippled, that there is still a way to live a life of purpose, fulfillment, happiness, and experience, regardless of what your own disability, difficulty, heartache, or hardship might be. If someone like me can pull it off, if I can travel the country by myself, alone, in the winter, while disabled, then anybody can and probably should.
That must have been so arduous.
It was, but rewarding at the same time.
Also with us is a former student and assistant to David. She's Jennifer Brewer. Welcome to you, Jennifer. Good to have you. Tell me, David, more about this glioma tumor and what it...
Sure. In 2006, I was diagnosed with brain cancer. Specifically, my tumor is of the glioblastoma multiform sort, which is the most aggressive form of cancer that there is, and I have it at its highest stage, which is why ultimately I suffered a stroke that took away my vision and the use of the left side of my body.
I can tell you've had some major surgery on your skull.
Since the time of being diagnosed, I've had 3 brain surgeries, 2.5 years of chemotherapy, and 6 weeks of radiation. I've gone through every kind of treatment out there, and I still went blind and crippled. So I decided to quit all treatment and hit the road to go visit my former students.
And how old are you?
I am 41 years old. Mm. But as they say, it's not the year, it's the mileage. And I've traveled quite a few hard roads and long miles.
Well, tell us more about, like, how many cities, how many miles, tell us the extent of your journey.
Well, when I realized I would no longer be able to teach, because I can't even drive anymore, Miami is very discriminatory against blind people. They don't even let us drive.
You sure?
I know. Judging by the people on the road, there might be a loophole to that rule. So when I realized I wouldn't be able to teach anymore, I was sitting at home feeling purposeless and unfulfilled, bored and restless. So I put a post on Facebook to my former students, letting them know that I'd like to do some traveling, and I asked who had a couch for me. Within 48 hours, I had offers from over 50 cities. And I set out on the road to see as many of them as possible. I ended up visiting 75 of my former students in 12 different, 76 of my former students in 12 different states. Mm. I spent 101 consecutive days traveling before settling down to do some writing. And then I did some more. I went to Hawaii to visit Gita in Maui. And the book that I wrote, The Priority List, is a memoir, but more importantly, it is about that trip and my reconnecting with students after 15 years to find out if I made a difference, and if so, exactly what that difference was.
Why did you have such a preoccupation with seeing the Pacific Ocean?
Well, I had grown up here in Florida with the Atlantic Ocean always at my side, the warm, calm Atlantic, but the Pacific is a completely different creature. Right. Well, compared to the Pacific, it is very calm. The Pacific is an angry ocean, and it lets you know it is. Huge crashing waves and sub-zero temperatures. I'd heard so much about it that I just wanted to see it. And since I was diagnosed with brain cancer, I had this sense of urgency that if ever there was a time to do the things I wanted to do, to see the places I wanted to see, it was now.
You say that when you have terminal brain cancer, you develop a certain fearlessness, as in what's the worst thing that can happen. So in your life prior to this, had fear prevented you from doing things that you had wanted to do?
No, I've never been a very fearful person.
And I see. Well, our audience can't see.
I have a tattoo on my right wrist that says, "Be brave." which is a daily and constant reminder of what's going to be necessary of me to live this life of happiness that I had dreamed about.
So how would you say your illness has transformed you? It gave you a sense of urgency, but you've Yes. always been fearless. But what other ways?
It's also given me a true sense of appreciation, not just for the days that I'm living, but for my past, my students, the time I spent with them. With it all coming to a close, it's hard not to become sentimental and start looking back on the past and wanting to recapture it. And by being with my students, I was able to go back in time to that period when I was fully sighted, had two working hands, and I was a teacher.
And prior to your illness, how important were your students, teaching, your classroom? How important was that in your life? Was it your life?
It was my life. It was my life's calling. It's what gave me happiness. It's how I spent my days, and as a teacher, nights, preparing and grading papers. And it was everything to me. So when I got brain cancer, I knew I would die from it, but that wasn't really the hardest part. The hardest part was becoming disabled to the point where I could no longer teach, a fate worse than death to me. Because now I'm alive, but without my classroom, it's difficult to figure out what it is that makes all the chemotherapy and treatment worthwhile.
How long did you teach after your diagnosis, and did the students know that you'd been diagnosed?
I was diagnosed the day before Thanksgiving in 2006, and my students knew because I have this huge scar on the right side of my head. It was the elephant in the room. So on the first day of school, I would let the kids know that if they had any questions for me, that I was open to answer them, and inevitably, one of my students would be brave enough to ask about the scar, to which I would respond honestly that I have brain cancer. But I told them, don't worry about it. I've got it. I'm fine. I'm going to be here for you. And I kept my word. Even through daily doses of radiation, I didn't miss a day of school.
I wanted to ask you this later, but I'd like to know now, where does your health stand today? Have you resumed treatment, and could you stay the same, or could you ever go into remission?
It's unlikely. Brain tumors do not shrink. They either stay the same size, which is the good news that you're stable, or they grow, which is obviously very bad news. And as of my last MRI, I am stable. And it was actually the first of 42 MRIs that I've had that gave me better results than the previous one. So I'm actually doing better now than I have in years.
After reading all about you, I didn't know what to expect when the elevator door opened and to see you, but you seem to be very functional.
Well, I am.
You are. I mean, if you could travel the United States.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it kind of expensive?
No. Hitchhiking is very cheap.
Oh, you were hitchhiking.
Hitchhiking, catching rides, and traveling by train. It was all land travel. I wanted to see the sights while I could.
Jennifer Brewer, how did David inspire students in your experience?
Well, David was unlike any teacher that many of us in high school had ever had before. He truly cared about each of his students on an individual level, and that just meant the world to us to know that someone was out there and cared for us. And so, you know, just seeing the difference that he made in my own life as well as thousands of other kids really inspired me and made me want to be an English teacher as well and have the same opportunities.
Is that what you're studying for now?
Yes.
Are you in college?
Yes.
And where?
I'm in the process of transferring to FIU. Mm-hmm. So when we come back from New Orleans, I'll be resuming school.
I want to get to the subject, the title of the book, but with David. But before I do, I just want to ask you, because that exercise seemed so amazing, making the priority list. Do you still make them today?
I do. I actually still have my original priority list from his class. And every now and then I'll sit down and do one again and just compare it to the one from high school. It's just really interesting to see how much I've grown as a person and how much my priorities change. It's something that can change on a daily basis depending on what happens. So,
okay, so David, tell us about that assignment, because it's pretty creative. Your students were struggling, evidently, with Othello, and you came up with this idea?
Initially, I came up with a list of 10 abstract words, words such as power, career, respect, and I had my students put them in order of importance for each of the characters. So when it came to someone like Othello, the title character, they would put marriage very high on the list, honor high on the list, whereas Iago, the villain of the play, it was more like career and power. But then, because I saw the assignment was so successful and the kids were really enjoying doing it, I expanded the list to 26 words, had words on there such as love, fun, family, friendship, and then I had them put them in order of personal importance, writing a number one next to the word that meant the most to them and a 26 by the word that meant the least. But the first step for my students was to define these words. It's difficult enough as an adult to figure out what love means, but at 16, when worlds are changing so rapidly, this is the age when kids are getting their driver's licenses, having their first romances, experimenting with drugs and alcohol, all while they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with their lives. Join the military, go to college, what do they want to do for an occupation, where do they want to live? So with so much rapid change, I wanted to create an assignment that would force my kids to slow down and truly consider what was important to them. And once they figured it out, I saw it as my job to help them achieve those dreams.
We're speaking to David Menashe. He taught English at the renowned mega magnet, Coral Reef Senior High School, for 15 years. And he's written The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. Also with us, Jennifer Brewer. She's a former student of David's and his assistant. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll come back and take some calls.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, David Menashe, and also Jennifer Brewer. We're talking about David's book, The Priority List, A Teacher's Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question of David, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that might even be faster, radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. David, despite this diagnosis and being such a young man, you don't seem to feel that you've been cheated by life.
Not in the least. Although I wish that life was nothing but love and laughter, joy and happiness, the truth of it is there's a lot of pain and suffering involved. And my cancer and the resulting disabilities are part of life. And although it hurts and it's unfortunate that I fall down and walk into things all the time, at least I'm above ground and I'm feeling things, good and bad, and I'm very appreciative of that. I do have the most aggressive form of cancer out there, so any day above ground is a good day and I appreciate it.
You know, we just listened to Jennifer. It seems as though you were so much more than an English teacher. To your students, you were a counselor, a confidant, a psychologist almost, a role model, a friend. Did you have a mentor or teacher that inspired you to become the teacher you did, or was it for a lack of one?
Well, it's a bit of a combination of both. I didn't have the greatest teachers in my early childhood, and I wanted to be a better teacher than a lot of the ones that I had, but I had some great ones as well. For instance, when I was in college, I couldn't afford the upcoming tuition for the next semester. I was studying to be a journalist at the time.
And where was that?
This was in the early 90s.
Where?
In New York, at the New School for Social Research, mm-hmm. Eugene Lang College. So I missed the semester where I was scheduled to do an internship at Spin Magazine, which would have really launched my career as a journalist. But because I missed out on that semester, I also missed the internship. And my favorite professor at the time, Mark Statman, introduced me to a program known as the Teachers and Writers Collaborative, which took writers or up-and-coming writers such as myself and put us in a New York public school classroom for 1 week, giving us the opportunity to teach. I was placed in an elementary school in upstate New York with a group of first graders, six-year-olds. And this was in the winter time, and there was a frozen pond out front of the school, which enamored me. I had never seen anything like this, being a Miami kid myself. Mm-hmm. So on the way to the school, I was asking my professor, Mark, what should I teach them? And he said, whatever it is you love, the kids will pick up on your excitement and love and they'll return it. And at the time, I was really into the poetry of Walt Whitman. So I got to the class, stood up in front of all the six-year-olds, which were squirming in their seats. They really didn't want to sit still in the
least. They didn't want to hear Leaves of Grass.
No less for
Song
poetry.
Of myself.
Yes.
But Mark was right. I was truly excited to be there and to read this poetry, and the kids were getting into it. And they asked, how One student in particular asked, how do I become a poet? So I got an idea. And I gave every kid in the class a small stack of Post-it notes and 3 crayons, told them to put on their coats and gloves and scarves, and I marched them outside to the pond. And I told them, okay, on each one of these pieces of paper, I want you to write down one thing that you see. So they ran around the snow, stomping around, doing this for a little while. And then when I saw they were getting cold, I had one little girl with frozen snot on her upper lip and another boy shivering, I marched them back into the classroom like a line of frozen little duckies. And then I told them, okay, stick your notes on the board. They were all running around the classrooms, happy not to be confined to their seats. And a couple of them stuck them up there a bit haphazardly. So I said, no, you have to put them in an order that sounds good to you. So the kids rearranged them until they liked the sound of their words. Words such as rock, footprint, leaf, the things that they saw outside by this lake. And then I sat down at the computer and I typed up all of their poems, printed them out, and then handed the poems out to the students who had written them, and then congratulated the class and said, congratulations, you're now all poets, just like Walt Whitman. And I heard this unanimous squeal of, must have been 25 six-year-olds, so happy to know they were now poets. And at that moment, I was hooked. And I realized that I didn't want to be a journalist anymore, that I wanted to have this effect on people, and I wanted to feel this kind of excitement on a daily basis.
How does it feel to know that you've influenced the lives of so many people?
It is intimidating because I wasn't exactly sure what that influence was, which is the reason I set out to travel the country to visit my former students to find out what this difference I made was and if it was in fact positive. Now that I've taken the trip, visited 75 of my kids in 12 different states, I know I did have a positive influence. So it feels really good. It feels like a life well spent.
We have an
you've
email.
Gone to the you've seen the Pacific, you went to Hawaii. Is there any other big thing you want to do?
Well, right now I am an ambassador for Voices Against Brain Cancer, which is a charity organization that is seeking to raise funds to give to develop cutting edge research at some of the preeminent medical facilities in the
Voices
country.
Voices of cancer, you said?
Voices Against Brain Cancer.
Brain Cancer.
Yes,
brain cancer.
And their website is voicesagainstbraincancer.org. And if there's anybody listening today that feels that they could help out, I and I'm sure everybody in the organization would greatly appreciate it.
We'll put links on our Facebook page and also
Thank
our
you.
Website.
What a lot of people don't know is that when it comes to cancer, especially kids with cancer, brain cancer is the number one killer of 20-year-olds and under. And it is the number 2 killer of people 20 to 35 years old. It doesn't get as much press as other diseases do, but it is most certainly just as insidious as any other one I could name. And Voices Against Brain Cancer has created this community, putting together other patients such as myself with caregivers and medical professionals. And as of late, I have been serving really as a counselor for other people suffering from this disease. Because it is such an aggressive form of cancer that when people are diagnosed, they immediately think it is a death sentence. And I see it as my purpose to let them know that is not necessarily the case. I was diagnosed and given 2 months to live.
And that was 7 years ago.
7 years ago. And I'm not going to say it hasn't taken a toll on my life and on my body, but it did not kill me. And in those years, I did amazing things. Met great people, reacquainted myself with students I hadn't seen in 15 years, got to see cities I'd always wanted to see and had never been to. There is still a way to live happily and with purpose and fulfillment. And
now
if the book and I can serve as an example of that, then I'm still doing good things with my time.
Now, you're a Miami guy, and you taught here for many years, and now you're living in New Orleans.
That is correct.
You wanted to walk on the wild side a little bit?
I relate to New Orleans. Like me, it is a city that has been through catastrophe and is looking to reinvent itself without losing touch with what it is. And I'm very similar to that. I've been through a lot, and I still want to be the guy that I always have been. And this trip, in large part, helped with that. When I was younger, I was never a tough guy or anything of that sort, but I had confidence. And losing the ability to see and use my hand stole that confidence from me, and I wanted it back. And you can't just tell yourself you're confident. You have to earn it. And I figured that if I can survive a cross-country trip by myself in the winter in the coldest places in the country. When I was in Minneapolis, it was 20 degrees below zero. And for a Miami kid like me, that's not just cold.
And you were hitchhiking?
Not a lot, but when necessary. For the most part, I was taking trains. But 20 degrees below zero is the temperature of the apocalypse for me. I mean, it is not a temperature. It is a torture.
Sounds like you've proven an awful lot during these.
And it has given me that confidence back, which I think is quite inspiring to my students, because many of them haven't seen me since I became disabled. And when I showed up to their town with a blind man's cane and a limp, at first I felt that sympathy, that pity, like, oh, this is terrible. But as soon as the epiphany came upon them that even like this, I traveled all the way across the country, that pity kind of evaporated and there was a sense of pride, like, wow, this guy can do this, which is just what I was hoping for, because chances are one of them will get sick or know somebody who gets sick, mm-hmm. and they may not know anybody else in their life who had been through it other than me. And I wanted to set an example that said, there's no reason to panic. You're still going to be able to live a life, a fruitful, worthy life. I mean,
it's a very powerful message.
Yes.
And just, I want to mention that David will be appearing at Books and Books this evening at 8 o'clock, Books and Books in Coral Gables on Aragon Avenue. That's tonight at 8.
Yes.
Right?
I'll be doing a reading and a book signing.
Okay. And if you're a former student of David's and you'd like to share your experience, you can call us at 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Or if you're not a former student, you just want to join in the conversation, you're more than welcome to call us. So we do have an emailer who wants to know, it could be that your treatment was frightening for some students. Should parents of minors have some say on whether or not teachers' personal experiences are shared in the classroom? Did any parents confront you about explaining your cancer to their kids?
No, I never had any upset parent that I was being honest about cancer. I was always a very honest person, and especially as a teacher, I treated my students as adults, which meant telling them the truth. Besides, with the scar like this on my head and having seizures in the classroom in front of my kids, there was no way to hide it.
How did your family react to this diagnosis?
Well, I have many members of my family, and there was definitely a range. But as soon as I got the diagnosis, because this was the day before Thanksgiving, and I knew I was going to have to tell my entire family in mass at Thanksgiving.
Oh my gosh.
I immediately just said, don't worry about me. I've got this. No tears, no trembling. And it wasn't that I was lying or putting on an act. I just didn't want to frighten anybody. So I set a standard for myself that said this would be my burden. I wasn't going to have other people suffer through it with me, not my students, not my family. I most certainly didn't want my mother to cry. So I let her know that I was fine and that I would be able to handle this. And that if anybody had to get brain cancer, it was good that it was me. In all other ways, I'm healthy, young. I don't have children of my own. I had health insurance. There was really no reason to be worried. And although they were frightened about me going on the trip, traveling by myself, once it was over, I had proven my point that I've got this. And my mother, even though now she is still frightened for what the future may hold, she's very proud of me and knows that I am capable of taking care of myself, which is
miraculous. I guess she would be proud of you.
Yeah. We're speaking with David Menashe, and his book, his memoir, is entitled The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons, and a former student, Jennifer Brewer. We need to take another break, and we'll be right back.
And 34 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, David Menashe, and also Jennifer Brewer. We're talking about his book, The Priority List, and it can be... You can look that up on Facebook.
Right. If you just go to Facebook and look up The Priority List, you can find David if you've been looking for him or would like to contact him.
And our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, email radio@WLRN.org. Scott in Miami, you've been on for a while. Thanks for your patience.
Not a problem. All I was going to say was, it's funny you talk about reinventing yourself. I am a 61-year-old individual who used to be a jazz pianist by profession, and I am now presently attending classes at the Miami Lighthouse for the Blind, which is an incredible institution, learning music production there. And I just, you know, it struck me about you talking about reinventing yourself and so forth and so on. And I'm wondering, you know, what the pitfalls were of reinventing yourself and what you think, you know, could any advice you could give on doing so.
David?
Yes. Well, firstly, I didn't want to have to reinvent myself. This came upon me. The person I had always identified myself as was fully sighted, had two hands, and a classroom in front of him. But once I lost all of those things, I was left with little choice but to reinvent myself. But I think it is a very healthy thing for people to do. I think people have a tendency to fall into ruts and just repeat the routine of their daily existence, which isn't necessarily the worst thing. But in my case, there was so much out there left to be done that the idea of just sitting on the couch and watching television was a fate worse than death. So I wanted the adventure. I wanted the love and the connection that my students offered me. I mean, when I was 16 years old, if I had seen a teacher of mine at the grocery store, I would have panicked and ran the other way. And here are students of mine not only opening their homes to me, but letting me into their lives, sleep on their couches, in their living rooms, meeting their spouses and their children, visiting their places of work. It really was magical.
You know, as much as you wanted to teach your students about the greats of English literature, it turned out it was the moments when you weren't teaching and when you were relating personally with your students that meant the most to them. That was one of the things you learned. How much does that mean to you?
Oh, that means so much that I can't even put it into words. I was paid to teach literature, but those moments that my students remembered, the times during lunch and before and after school when we were just sitting across from my desk having a personal conversation about whatever was happening in their lives that I could help with. First of all, the fact that they even came to me was an honor. And then later finding out that my advice was sound and really helped out a lot of these kids really made me feel tremendous.
Tell us a little more about Coral Reef. It sounds like it's quite a place. And also then to have Jennifer follow with how she
certainly
enjoyed it.
Coral Reef Senior High School was recently ranked as the number 46th high school in the public high school in the country out of over 2,000 schools. So it is truly.
And it's a magnet.
Yes, it is. With academies in visual and performing arts, which Jen was a member of in the chorus strand. Also business, legal, medical. So kids are taking the basic classes such as science, math, and English, as all students do, but they're also taking classes that specialize within the field of their magnet. So they're taking classes on law or medicine or business or wherever they are. So it is a normal high school in the sense that they learned English, science, and math, but it is more than that in that it is giving the students the ability to prepare themselves for their occupations far earlier in life than most people get to.
Do they, when they take those classes, law or medicine or whatever, do they get any credit toward college?
It's not college credit, with the exception of the International Baccalaureate Academy. Those kids did get college credit. But for instance, the kids in the medical academy were graduating already prepared to be first responders, some paramedics, nurses, already knowing the language, the jargon of the field, and really feeling that they had a head start in that career.
And your experience, Jennifer?
Well, Coral Reef was a phenomenal school, and I'm so grateful that I was able to go there. As David said, I was in the chorus, which was part of the Visual and Performing Arts Academy, and it was such a great experience. The chorus was renowned all over the nation. We got to go on some wonderful trips, and there was just a real sense of community in the school. I'm still really close with so many of my friends from chorus who I still consider to be my best friends.
And yet you're studying to be an English teacher and not a singer.
Yes, I initially wanted to be a choral music teacher, but you know, David's influence, I loved his class so much and fell in love with reading and writing that I wanted to do that instead.
Let's take another call or two on our program. Tony in Key Biscayne, hi there.
Yeah, hi. How are you? Nice to meet you all.
Mm-hmm.
I really just had a comment and a quick question. My comment is that I also was recently diagnosed with a serious form of cancer, but I happen to be the father of one of David's former students, Jana. And I wanted David to know that during the 4 years that Jana was at Coral Reef, of all of the teachers that she had during that four-year period, David's is actually the only teacher's name I actually know and remember. And the reason for that isn't because he had cancer. It's because Jana used to come home every day for many days telling me about what a wonderful teacher her English teacher was. And that's how I remember David, and I wanted to say thank you to him for that. Jana, by the way, I think having gotten a lot from Mr. Menashe's classes, is now pursuing her passion as a musician in New York, and she's very, very happy.
That's excellent. Thank you for the update, Tony. I appreciate it, and all of your kind words. Please let Jana know that I remember her like it was yesterday, and I'm truly proud of her for achieving exactly what she talked about back in high school, wanting to be a performer, wanting to live in New York City, and I'm truly honored to have been part of that for her.
Well, thank you. And the question that, the one question that I had for you, and then I'll listen offline, is how did your priority list change from before the diagnosis to afterward?
And Tony, before you go, we want to wish you very well with whatever your diagnosis is.
Yes.
We wish you the best.
Thank you.
Tony, please maintain hope that things will get better and the strength to endure until they do. Which leads me to my answer to your question. Up until diagnosis, I would have put honor as my number one on the list of the 26 words. But ironically, my new number one is a word that wasn't even on the list when your daughter did it. Strength. Strength, the ability to endure what I just wished you, is what I really value most in my life right now. I want to be able to endure this new reality of mine long enough to continue enjoying all of these wonderful experiences that I'm having along the way.
David, okay. I was going to ask you about your priority list because I was very surprised that you put spirituality at the very bottom.
No, it's not at the bottom.
It's not at the bottom?
No, it is not. In fact, I consider myself a very spiritual
person.
That's
what I was going to say.
Very. I've never really been able to align myself with the dogma of any organized religion.
Okay.
But I definitely consider myself a spiritual person. I think at the bottom of my own list would probably be possessions. Especially after traveling the country and trying to travel as light as possible,
mm-hmm.
I may do with the bare minimum of essential items. So these days, possessions are not very important to me at all, material possessions. Shelter is another one, which is probably relatively low on the list. I love to travel. I love being out there.
Where do you put learning?
Well, learning isn't on the list, but education is.
Okay.
Education would be in my top five, and I try to consider myself a lifelong learner. Even though I became a teacher, I was learning as much from my students as they were learning from me. And while traveling, although many of them thank me for being their teacher, it was really me that was thanking them for giving my life such meaning and such happiness.
And would you say that the most important moments or the best moments in your career teaching were also the moments that they were for your students, the ones not necessarily teaching?
Absolutely. If they didn't get anything out of it, then it was a low point in my career, not a high. Very good question. Thank you, Bonnie. There's no question that my students' successes were shared by me, as were their failures. I was teaching AP classes, advanced placement, and at the end of the year, they took a test, the AP exam, which, if they did well enough on, would earn them college credit.
Mm-hmm.
And if my students did poorly on that exam, it was my failure. It was not theirs. And subsequently, when they did well, and usually they did do well, my pass rates were very, very high, I shared in their victory. Victory is one of the words on the list, and my personal definition of victory was my students' success. That if I could bring them to success, then I was a success. And if they failed, it was because of my failures.
It seems like you're still a really great teacher, And you're still teaching.
Thank you, Bonnie. I'm trying my best.
We're speaking with David Menashe. He taught English at Coral Reef Senior High School, a mega magnet school, it's called, for 15 years. He was one of the founding teachers, and in 2012, he was awarded Teacher of the Year by his region. It's his first memoir. It's called The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. One more short break, and we'll return.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, David Menashe, and also Jennifer Brewer. Let's take a few more calls. We've got Lisa. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi, David. Hi, guys. How are you today?
Good.
Doing well. Thank you for calling, Lisa.
I just wanted to point out, but I love the fact that you said that you can still have brain cancer and have a fruitful life. Long life even after that. My uncle was diagnosed with brain cancer when I was just 14, 15 years old, and I'm now 35, and he just passed 2 years ago. And I can't remember how many times I went to the hospital for all of the surgeries, the radiation therapy, how many times I've been in and out of hospice. They knew us at that point. But he kept fighting. He just didn't want to give up, and the biggest impact was that he got to see his daughter grow up. And it's just, you can have so much more as long as you just keep that strength, that will to live. And you know, he still had a really great life out of it.
I'm glad to hear it, Lisa. I'm sorry for your loss, but I'm glad to hear that he lived well. Largely, it seems, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your
call. Thanks, Lisa.
What were your initial symptoms that made you go and get checked out?
Initially, I was hearing a ringing sound in my left ear. And I went to my doctor.
Probably thought it was tinnitus or something?
Well, my doctor sent me to a series of specialists, ear, nose, and throat people, that showed there was nothing wrong with my ears. And then eventually that ringing sound turned into a tingling sensation that I was feeling across my face and down the left side of my body. At that point, my doctor sent me to a neurologist who gave me a series of tests that all had acronyms for names, EEG, EKG, CAT, MRI. And finally, it was the MRI that revealed I had a brain tumor.
I think we all fear.
I didn't realize it at the time.
When we're told we have this terminal illness.
Well, I didn't know it was terminal yet. I was very, very naive about cancer and tumors in general. For instance, those sensations I was feeling, I didn't realize it, but those were seizures. And I was having seizures for years before I even went to a doctor about it. And then when I found out I had a brain tumor, I asked my doctor, again, very naively, is it benign? To which he said, there's no such thing as a benign brain tumor. So then again, I clarified and said, well, is it cancer? He said, yes, I'm sorry, you have brain cancer. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. I'd never met anybody who had brain cancer. It was always one of those diseases that you use as an example to show that things aren't really so bad. It's not brain cancer.
Exactly.
And then suddenly I had it and had to have brain surgery, which again was an example of, you know, things that are difficult. At least it's not brain surgery. And suddenly I was the butt of all of those jokes.
And so you were afraid initially, would you say?
I was not afraid of dying. I have always understood that dying is a natural process and something that we are all going to do. What made me at the time more frightful is what my life was going to be like with cancer. And spending 4 to 5 days out of every week at the hospital between physical therapy, occupational therapy, and chemotherapy, labs, and doctor appointments is not how I wanted to live. I didn't want to solely be defined as a patient, as a cancer patient.
What would have happened if you hadn't had the insurance from the school system?
Then I wouldn't have been able to receive treatment, and we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
You say that you learned in your travels that most people don't want to be free. They want to be safe and secure.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, I asked people to join me as I was traveling, and nobody wanted to come. I mean, I can understand why, but people didn't want to leave the security of their lives, their couches, their homes, their neighborhoods, family, friends. And I have learned that, unfortunately, you can't have freedom and security at the same time. It's a choice. It's one or the other. And for me, to quit all treatment to go on this road trip really was trading in all of my safety and security for freedom, but I needed that freedom. I had spent years tethered to hospital beds by IV tubes and needles, and I just wanted to break free from that existence and live a life that was worth putting up with all that treatment.
And we'll move along. Another caller from Coral Springs. This is Abby. Hi.
Hi, it's actually Avi and I'm sorry. Bonnie. I love your show always. Bonnie, very quickly, I had the honor of meeting you at the opening of the Gable Stage Show. My name is Oscar Liv.
Okay.
We have a terrible connection.
I know, I'm on the road. I'm so sorry. Is this better?
Not really.
Oh, God. Well, I love your show, and I hope, David, that you will adapt your work to the stage or the screen.
Oh, he's saying he hopes you'll adapt your work to the stage or the screen.
We have to let you go. We have a horrible connection.
All right, connection. So okay. Sorry.
Thanks. Okay, thank you for calling,
Thank you for calling, Abby.
And is there another one?
Yes. We've got Fran in Fort Lauderdale. Hi. Fran, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a retired English teacher myself, and first of all, I want to say to David how proud I am to count him amongst English teachers. He's truly inspirational.
Thank you, Fran. I truly appreciate it.
And then I wanted to ask you, first of all, I would love to see your book as required reading for first-year teachers. And I'm working now with first-year teachers. And I wanted to ask you if there was one piece of advice that you could give a first-year teacher going into the classroom, what would it be?
Do not teach the class. Teach the individuals in the class. These days, public education is encouraging all teachers to use differentiated instruction to teach towards a standardized test, which seems like just an impossible task. But rather than seeing a mass of 40 people in front of you, see a series of individuals. Look into their eyes, look at their expressions, and modify your lessons accordingly. Too many teachers are just stuck in that rut of workbooks and worksheets, and never really getting in touch with what their kids are and are not appreciating, are and are not learning. I would encourage first-year teachers to get to know their students as individuals before attempting to teach them as a class.
Have you considered at all lecturing to colleges of education?
I never lectured as a teacher. I wouldn't want to do so now.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Fran.
Thank you for your call, Fran.
You know what's amazing? What's amazing is that you knew immediately that when Tony, was it Tony that called up with the daughter, Jana?
Jana, yes.
How long ago did you have Jana as a student?
12 years ago, I believe. Oh, maybe gosh. 13.
And you knew her immediately.
Yes.
Well, exactly who he was talking
luckily
about.
Luckily, she has an original name. Had she been named Maria, it may not have been quite as easy, but Jana left an impression on me. She was a very good student, highly motivated, and extremely curious. And honestly, I will take a curious, motivated student over a smart one any day. And Jana was that. Jana was open-minded and really wanted to learn, wanted to broaden her horizons, get out of Florida, and live in a new place and have adventures. And according to Tony, it seems like she's doing that now. So
right, but I still find it remarkable that 12 years after the fact, you knew exactly who it was.
Well, that is not in any way a credit to me. It is a credit to her.
I can't remember a guest we had on the program last week.
Well, that's their fault more than yours. They should have done something more memorable.
Jana, we won't forget you, though.
David, you're speaking to so many different people in this book. You're speaking to students, teachers, those with crippling or terminal illness. Who else and what would you like them to discover when they read your book?
Well, hopefully your listeners also become readers. And what I'd really like everybody to know is that no matter what your horrific situation may be, God forbid you should too go blind and crippled, that even if something like that should happen, that there is still a way to live a life of fulfillment, purpose, happiness, and honor. And if I could do it, then anybody can.
I don't know about that.
I don't know. We
about
have
the information about
yes,
tonight.
Yes, but before I okay, we only have like 15 seconds left for you to answer this.
Sure.
I know Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain are your favorites. Have your favorites changed since you became ill? Do you have a new favorite
no,
author?
No, quite the opposite, in fact. I've gone back to these favorite works of mine to reread them with a new perspective and have gained an even fuller appreciation of those works.
And tonight, Books and Books, Coral Gables, 8 p.m. David will be there for book signing and reading. So if you'd like to meet him, go on over to Books and Books.
8 o'clock tonight. And again, David has written The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. We'll also have a link for voicesagainstbraincancer.org. David and Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you. And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Remember, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, including book and author links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with British sociologist and writer Roman Krusnarek. He's written, How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. Also, Linda Gastneimer's Food and Dining. And today's calendar, on this day 1973, 41 years ago, the death of President Lyndon Baines Johnson in Stonewall, Texas, age 64. In his U.S. Senate career, he's considered the most effective majority leader in history, famous for, quote, the treatment, withholding nothing to cajole votes from lawmakers. And on this day 1973, 41 years ago also, the Supreme Court decision in the case of Jane Roe versus Henry Wade. Wade was the district attorney of Dallas County. It struck down Texas laws banning abortion in most cases. And one more on this day, 1998, 16 years ago, survivalist Theodore Kaczynski pleads guilty to being the notorious Unabomber in exchange for life imprisonment. His 16 male bombs killed 3 and injured 23. Our theme music created and performed by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from LBJ, who succumbed to his third heart attack. Quote, if one morning I walked on top of the water across the Potomac River, the headline that afternoon would read, President Can't Swim. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay with us next hour for Here and Now from NPR News.